This is the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. Bill Russell and I are delighted to be with Doris Kearns Goodwin, who, as she said, lived with Abraham Lincoln for 10 years, as your husband did as well. One of the things that I found really moving, really one of these big ideas, was I found two great men in this book. I found a lot of very interesting men. I found, and women. I found lots of things to admire and to not admire. There are two men who really stand out in this book for me, and they are Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass. And I say that because I want to talk a little bit about the fact that with all of these folks around him who have wealth and experience and education and da-da-da-da-da-da-da, the two men who stand out in this great Civil War story are the two men who come from the very least of material circumstance. And was that striking to you?
Oh, absolutely. And the two men who both had to educate themselves. I mean, the story of Frederick Douglass, you know, somehow against all odds, learning to read when it was considered against the law.
He was still a slave.
He was still a slave at that point. And then coming north, becoming a great orator, criticizing Lincoln. Probably Lincoln read his criticisms and was moved by them before he met him more than anyone else's, because I think he could tell what a great writer that Douglass was and develop this great respect for him. And then finally they get to meet. And that first meeting is really an astonishing thing, because Douglass comes in feeling like, I'm not going to like this guy, and he's going so slow on emancipation, and he hasn't brought black troops into the army, and he hasn't issued a retaliatory order, all these things that he's upset about. And yet he says at the end of that meeting that it was the first great man he ever sat with who exhibited no condescension, who never made him feel there was a matter of color. And he had talked with abolitionists, Wendell Phillips and Lloyd Garrison, and then somehow they develop a certain bond, see each other another couple times after that. And I think Lincoln looks to Douglass and is aware that he wants Douglass's good opinion of him. And meanwhile, Douglass is beginning to have a more extraordinary opinion of him. And I love the moment when he invites Douglass to the second inaugural. And it's one of the first times that a black man has ever been invited as a social function to the White House. So, of course, they keep him out. You can't possibly be having an invitation in there. And he goes, finally, they have to bring him in. And Lincoln immediately strides across the room. Oh, my friend Douglass, come talk to me. And then he asked Douglass's opinion of the second inaugural. And Douglass said he was shy. Why would he want my opinion? But he finally said, Mr. President, it was a sacred effort, at which point Lincoln went happily away, knowing that his opinion mattered. And at the very end, Douglass gave a speech after Lincoln died in which he said, from the point of view of an abolitionist or a radical, he was slow in moving on racial relations, but he was president of all the people. And in that sense, he was radical himself. He understood the difference between an agitator and a politician. So I found their relationship fascinating. I'm so interested you did, because it's not a huge part of the book, but it was an emotionally satisfying part for me.
I just want to finish this thought. Part of why it seemed to me that both of them were great was because they had, you used the word crystalline, crystallizing. You talk about Lincoln really had Shakespeare, the Bible, the Declaration of Independence, and the Constitution, and maybe Andrew Jackson's something or other. Frederick Douglass has the alphabet.
Right.
They
right.
don't have all the distractions and the play dates and the something and the something. The fact that they were so constrained and had to go deep inside what they did have and themselves seemed to me to be a really important thing to say in this noisy, what's the diagnosis, this crazy modern noisy era, when we've got too much and it's everywhere and it's dispersed and da 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 da, and I got to have more. Wait a minute. These two great seminal characters in the 19th century had nothing and
Absolutely.
Became great.
And, you know, I think it tells us maybe that our educational system today is just too scattered, too disparate. Because if you could just have some really great things you're reading and learn them in depth, I mean, especially if you're going to be a writer, the cadences that Lincoln got from the King James Bible, from Aesop's fables, from Shakespeare's plays, which he could, from poetry, that he could recite and memorize, perhaps going deeper into a smaller segment of something. I think about that for the way history's taught. You know, I'm afraid the exams that we make the kids pass now to get out of high school sometimes require this breadth of knowledge, but so superficial. Whereas maybe if we just taught it more biographically, if they could learn about a person in a certain era, they might not be able to know everything that happened in the era, but they'd feel that era, and they'd put it in context. And that may bring history to life, which it seems not to be doing for young children.
One of the interesting things about the relationship with Douglass, and you mentioned that at some point in dealing with the blacks and dealing specifically with Douglass, that his empathy failed him.
Right.
And it failed him because he had not had the contact that he had with the other citizens of the community. And I say that because, again, bringing it into the present, we've created a presidency increasingly separated from any contact with the real world.
A royalty.
We have tended over the last several years to select people as president who have no real world experience. They are ignorant of how most of us live, how the citizens of the country live. And Lincoln was spot on when he was dealing with people he knew, people he could empathize with. His some of his early failings with respect to the black community is he had not spent time with them and he was incapable of empathizing with them.
That's exactly right. In fact, early on, he thought that most blacks would prefer to go back to the Africa from which they had been taken because they'd have a chance for equality there, which he wasn't sure they'd ever have here in America. But that was because he didn't understand this was their homeland, for good or ill, this being America. And Douglass helped him to understand that, so he gave up that colonization scheme. But in the larger sense, he understood that he had to keep that White House open to the ordinary people. His staff would be despairing at times with the amount of time that he spent with the job seekers who ran in. They could actually go right into his office and said, I want this job. Or how much time he spent shaking hands at these receptions, which in complete contrast to today, anybody could walk in the White House. Backwoodsmen are standing side by side with diplomats. But he said, these are my public opinion baths. And I've got to remember the great popular assemblage from which I've come. You're so right. I mean, today, it's not just security, but the White House in the last 50 years, really, has become a cocoon. And every whim of the president's is answered. I like to tease about the fact that, you know, when President Johnson liked a particular ballpoint pen, it seemed like truckloads of the pen would come in. You know, when Hail to the Chief is played, when you walk in the room, you lose that sense of where you come from. And more today, I think, even the staff that works for the president has a very rarefied life. No wonder they don't understand the mood of the people after a while.
And it seems to me in that same sense of empathy that part of Lincoln's challenge with respect to his generals was he had virtually no military experience.
Just that little Black Hawk War where he said the only thing he fought were mosquitoes.
but once he started, you know, those trips out to dealing with the army, but also with the officers, and some strong words from his staff, from his cabinet members, that he was in fact the commander in chief. But as he began to be able to understand, to connect with those people, with the military and military officers and generals, that he became much more assertive and much more capable in his directing of the war.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, he had to absorb what he didn't know. He had to have the curiosity, which he did, and he had to learn, you know, but he had a temperament that was open to learning. I mean, he even went to the Library of Congress and got books out on military strategy because you're right, when he got there, he had almost no experience. Sadly, most of the generals didn't have much experience in large armies either. And so he had to figure out how to shore up the weaknesses that he had. So he would have these long talks with the generals that he liked. He would talk with reporters. He would talk to people who'd come back from the field. He went to the field as often as he could, more than I realized. I mean, it was more than a dozen trips that he took. And some of them would be days at a time he'd be spending living in a tent right next to the soldiers. And all of that allowed him to be a much more understanding person of military strategy than he was when he first took office.
Well, and to go from McClellan, who was just a screaming egomaniac amongst his other failings, to go from McClellan to Grant and to Sherman, and you've got pictures of both of them in the book, thank you, and it is night and day. It is from what is good for me and my own parochial, extremely parochial egotistical needs to Grant, who basically will do what was going to do whatever was necessary to win the war, as was the case with Sherman.
You know, in fact, the great story that he tells that reminds me of Grant is that after he won the second term in June of 1864, his friends came to him and said, you know, there's nothing that'll prevent you from winning this election unless Grant takes Richmond. The Democratic convention had not yet taken place, and so he would probably get nominated. He would probably beat you in a general election.
He, Grant,
would beat you, Lincoln. And Lincoln said, well, I feel like you're a doctor, and you've just told me that I have a fatal disease. Now, I don't particularly want to die, but if I'm going to die, that's the disease I want to die of. Let's take Richmond. You know, I mean, again, that ability to realize that that's more important even than his winning the election for his larger goal of leaving something important behind. So let Grant have it. If he takes Richmond in time.
Doris Kearns Goodwin is our guest here on The Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon, we all three invite you to be with us in a moment when we will return.